This is episode 459 of the Autoblog podcast. I'm joined this week by Greg Migliori and Stephen Ewing. And we talk about Cadillac's Escalade problem, GMC begging for a compact crossover, the Ford F-150 going diesel and hybrid. That's all ahead on episode 459 of the Autoblog podcast. Hello, welcome to the Autoblog podcast. I'm Dan Roth. I'm joined this week by Greg Migliori.
Hey, Dan. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Great.
Awesome. And we're also joined by Stephen Ewing.
Good day, everyone.
Good day, sir. Good. And so let's start with the garage. Right. Stephen, what are you driving?
Well, I spent the weekend with the 2016 BMW 340i xDrive, which, if that number sounds different, it's actually just the new version of the 335i. BMW renamed the car to put it more in line with all of the other 40i models. So like the 640i and the 740i and all that stuff. So it's the 340, but it still has a turbo 3-liter inline six, 320 horsepower.
The N55.
Yeah. It gets an 8-speed automatic, but the one I had actually had the 6-speed manual. And so I wasn't always super hot on this generation of 3 Series. I thought it left a lot to be desired in terms of like interior quality and especially steering feel. I thought they really kind of didn't hit that as well as every other version of the 3 Series. And so I went out and I was driving this new one and I'm like, okay, it's a little bit better. The interior is still maybe not as nice. And I mean, it's hard to talk about the interior when we have things like the new C-Class, which, I mean, you get inside that car and you're like, whoa, every other car in the segment should have this. And the 3 Series right. Doesn't. But, you know, it drives a little bit better. And I'm like, okay, I can kind of get into this. And then I realized it's $60,000. And that kind of ruined it for me.
Yeah, see, I saw you sort of duking this out on Twitter with other car writers. And one of them did make the point that, you know, adjusting for sort of inflation-adjusted magic money, it's actually cheaper than the 3 Series was in other epochs and decades.
Which is true.
I don't know if that's good or bad. I mean, yeah, it's true. The 3 Series has always been a premium car. Would it be as good if we, you know, could buy it for Jetta money?
No, of course not. But I don't know, for some reason, and I mean, maybe that's just the price of the way things are going right now, but I did a price comparison and I spec'd out a Mercedes C450 AMG Sport, which has more power, a way nicer interior. I think it looks better outside, and it had pretty much all the same stuff that the 3 Series I was testing had, and it was the same price. So it's like,
yeah,
you know, suddenly the 340i, like if this were some, I don't know, like AMG Sport rival, maybe I could see it, but it's not. This is just the 3 Series. I mean, you can still get the 328i and you can get the 320i and there's still the diesel. So this is the top range 3 Series, but I drove a C450 AMG Sport and that car felt like AMG light. It felt really special. The 340 doesn't really feel like M3 light. Granted, I don't really like the M3, but it just feels like a 3 Series. And I mean, it's better now than I think it was pre-facelift and pre like engine retuning and all that. I think it's getting closer to where it was again, but man, $60,000 as tested, and my car didn't even have everything. I mean, you could get the M Sport package, you could get the automatic transmission, there are different wheels you could have on it. It just, I don't know, that maybe I'm crazy, but that seems like a lot of money.
You are. It's the enthusiast special. And, you know, if you just want the image, you've got, like you said, you've got the 328.
Right.
If you want the enthusiast special with the 6-speed and the inline turbo 6, like, you're going to pay for it. And a lot of people willingly do.
Yeah, that's true. But, I mean, the biggest thing for me is that the car, it's closer to feeling like a good 3 Series again. It didn't disappoint me like the F30 body style did when it first came out.
It's a nice car. I had one night in it too, and I was pretty stoked. I had driven a 3 Series in quite some time, so I took the long way home. I have this kind of twisty road that, you know, is a little bit by my house, and it's, you know, to Steve's point, 60 some grand is a lot for that car. And even inside, you were kind of like, This, I'm not sure if this totally feels like it warrants the price, but it's, you know, it's a really good chassis. You know, it's it feels, again, more like what the 3 Series, I think, is trying to be. And this one looked really cool. I mean, red paint, black wheels. I mean, it was a snazzy car.
Oh, see, the black wheels did not do it for me. Those looked so like Pep Boys on the red 3 Series.
No,
they did not look good. And it wasn't even that they were black or even like a graphite gray. They just looked like they were all covered in brake dust.
Hey, I just got back from SEMA, well, 6 weeks ago, but I'm still recovering.
Black wheels abound there, yeah.
And I was down with it. I thought it looked good. It's like, hey, you want a plasti dip your 3 Series? Do it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's an acquired taste. And it looks good in some places and not so good in others. And having owned a spiffy European car, I can say brake dust was the bane of my existence. Because they all do it. Like Mercedes, BMW, every European brand has like super ridiculous dusty brake pads.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can, and you know, not every color looks good with black wheels, but we've delved into minutia, so we should move on and talk about what Greg's driving this week. So what are you driving?
Just came in this morning in the 2016 Chevy Malibu, which was a, you know, important car for Chevy, for General Motors. So just from kind of like a, you know, from a newsy perspective, I was psyched to drive it. You know, this car is a big deal for them.
And then you drove it.
You know, so a lot of people around the office are already like, oh, it's so Malibu-y. But I liked it. I thought it was a premium-feeling car in many ways. I didn't like this sort of, like, diamond-like pattern. It was, like, all black, but it still kind of looked like a Father's Day tie material.
Oh, and that in, like, the cloth trim that they brought over from the cruise, kind of?
I don't know what was going on there, but I wasn't a fan of that.
Yeah, it's not... not fantastic. I mean, my whole thing with the Malibu is, you know, I talked to David Gluckman about this extensively after he drove it, which is, it's a nice car. It's the best Malibu Chevy's ever done. It has a lot to talk about. It has a lot, you know, there's a lot of reasons to praise it. The interior is finally the right size. It feels genuinely big in there. Visibility is great.
It's a big car.
It has all the right stuff. It's very quiet. It's very comfortable. But the whole time I'm driving it, like the engine sounds like crap, but it feels good. It's got enough power. But the whole time I kept driving it, I'm just like, I would so much rather be in an Accord right now.
I'm not sure I feel that way about the Accord, though. Like, I'll take the opposite tact. Like, the Accord's good. I don't know if it's that much better than the Malibu in this car. I mean, in this segment. It's like, to me, all of these cars tend to run together like, you know, mashed potatoes and corn and gravy. Like, they're just, it's all to me kind of the same thing. And I actually like how the Malibu looks inside and out, except for that crazy whatever material. So I think in some ways that's how it stands out, a little bit different. But, you know, to me, a lot of these cars are about the same. I wouldn't put this at the top of the segment, but I don't think it's at the bottom either. I think it's a very, very good car. And I think it's, you know, definitely competitive.
Yeah, it's going to make a really nice rental.
Exactly.
And that's yeah, okay. So now that the jokes are out of the way.
But
yeah, I mean, it is a very important car, and it's a pretty significant update for it. And while we would prefer the Accord because of the way the Accord drives, most people are going for the Accord because of its reputation and price.
But see, I still prefer the Accord for the interior spaciousness and the quality of it and the way it looks and drives and feels. And I mean, I will say the Malibu definitely feels lighter from behind the wheel than it ever has before. The steering was retuned and it's pretty good. I just like, I don't know, I don't really see this. Like, the big thing I keep thinking of is the Malibu is a finalist for the North American Car of the Year Award. And I'm thinking about all the other cars I would have picked instead of it.
Well, yeah, but those cars didn't debut. You know,
like, no, but even like the Volt, though. I'm thinking about like cars that I think are more important or more interesting or represent a better like accomplishment. Something like the new Volt versus the new Malibu. I mean, the Malibu.
It's very hard to make a very good midsize sedan, though. Like, you got price and aggressive competition, like, breathing down your neck, too. So that, I mean, we can make excuses either way, right? So
sure. It's just, to me, it doesn't feel like this is suddenly the best car in the class. It just feels like another good middle-of-the-pack entry.
So, like, with the Accord, though, I feel like I pick that car because of the way it drives, in spite of the other stuff in it that annoys the hell out of me. You know, like I would expect that the Malibu's infotainment is a whole lot easier to use
and
more responsive than what's in the either the Camry or the Accord. You know, the Camry is just the Camry's sort of there as the leader, but it's just not a great car. Like, if anything is a great rental, it's the Camry. And I would assume that jumping into a Malibu, I'd be like, yeah, this is like leaps and bounds better just because it's brand new, first of all, but also because, you know, it's got to be different. It's got to stand out in some way. And GM has got to be on their game. So I'm assuming, I haven't driven it yet, but I'm assuming that I should expect to be impressed from what I hear about it, regardless of sort of how it does in the class.
Yeah.
Like, it's definitely not going to, you know, start selling 400,000 a year, but it hopefully will do better, you know, and deliver an experience. Because the last Malibu wasn't a bad car either, right? It was just...
No, it was.
Meh. It was all right.
No, it was a bad car.
I like the interior of this new one. I mean, it's, you know, it's pretty slick in there. The touchscreen works really well. I was actually surprised about that just because touchscreens don't work for me. I don't know if I'm like a vampire and don't have fingerprints or something, but touchscreens don't work for me.
And this is also the man, by the way, that listening to Greg type is like listening to someone murder the keyboard.
Yeah, I learned to type on typewriters and I...
That's fantastic.
Type with a purpose, electric man. Action. Yeah.
Yeah.
What about
I did the same.
Well, what about you, Dan? What are you driving?
So last week somebody actually, I just wanted to sort of like touch on this. Somebody was like, you were so nice to the Mirage last week. What is the matter with you? And I don't know, maybe I was overly nice to it, but I wanted to put it in perspective. It is kind of a terrible car, but on the other hand, it's not that terrible. Like Volkswagen Beetles put lots and lots of Americans on wheels, and they were by far like an order of magnitude more terrible than the Mirage. So, of course, there's also like 80 years in between when they were both designed. So there's that. But this week they replaced that with a Dodge Charger SXT Premium, which is pretty nice, actually.
Interesting.
And part of it is just like I'm going from a Mirage to a Charger. The other part is that I still like the Charger.
I dig the Charger.
Yeah, it drives really well. It's, Chrysler desperately needs to follow this car up, though. Like, they've done a masterful job of keeping it sort of up to date and, making it respectable. They certainly filled it with the features and the design that are going to, you know, keep it at least fresh. But man, this is an old set of bones. And what are they following it up with? Like, what's the next Charger going to be?
I mean, isn't the rumor it's going to be like Alfa Romeo sort of underpinnings that like, you know, one of their big sedans, whether it's the Giulia or another one, they're all going to share kind of the same rear wheel platform underpinnings versions. And then like the 300 will get that as well. And supposedly that would give it sort of like a new, you know, new energy because, yeah, you're right. That's like what the old E-Class chassis, basically. I mean,
the very old E-Class. There's some very old E-Class in it.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of still a little fuzzy on how much there really is.
Right.
Especially, you know, by the time it's been through sort of cost reduction and those kind of, it's like how much Volvo is in the Ford Taurus, right? Like, there's a lot of it in there in terms of like DNA and basic engineering, but the parts don't interchange, you know, like, it's a very good car. It's just, there's a lot of very good cars around it. Although in that like large sedan world, like, there's a lot of offerings. I don't know if there's a lot of taking, right? Like, how's the Impala doing? How's the Taurus? How's the Taurus doing? So it feels like the 300 is still like probably the car I would pick in that segment just because it's pleasant to drive. There's some stuff about it that's still like, all right, guys, next time you revise this car, you got to change it. Like, the transmission tunnel is huge.
Yeah,
it's very big. Little passenger foot room. And it's like, it's one of those big cars outside, small cars inside, you know, all the things that we've commented on. But on the other hand, I'm mostly impressed with just how good it continues to be, given that it debuted in 2005. It's a 10-year-old car. So that's pretty impressive.
I mean, it looks different, though. I mean, wouldn't you say, though, it looks pretty different than that old, that decade-old car and a lot of the touch points, you know?
The best thing they did was update the interior, and they've really kept the styling fresh. Like, they've put time and effort and money into keeping the Charger up, and I think that shows because it doesn't drive like a 10-year-old car. Like, if I were to go back and drive an 05, 06 Charger, it'd feel ancient to me, I'm sure. But, and this one doesn't. This feels modern, and the design is nice, and the materials are great, and, you know, infotainment is really good. So it's sort of just like doing the most with what you have, I guess, is what I get out of it.
It's a good approach for them, you know, keep that, you know, lasting as long as it can. And, I mean, I could give you a point of reference. I own an 05. It's an 06 Charger, but I bought it in 05 that I never drive. And when you drive that car, it's like instant burnout. You know, it's all over the road. The steering is loose. It actually, looking through the prism of a decade later, I think it holds up really well. But yeah, the new car is much more sophisticated. It really is, you know, it drives with so much more poise. If you wanted to, you could do burnouts, you know, voluntarily rather than just involuntarily. And, you know, they've done a good job with it.
The important metric. Yeah. It's been kept up, and it's like they haven't really had a choice. It's either like keep it up or let it wither. And, it's a favorite of, you know, fleet drivers and
taxis, cop cars.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good car. It's probably the best big sedan. It's the only one that has a sort of a rear wheel drive architecture. So it gets some of the enthusiast heartstrings going. So it's still a, you know, I'm not going to ask somebody like, well, why'd you get a Charger? Like, I'd be like, oh, that's all right. Okay. Respect. Yeah, it really just raises the question to me of like, what are they following it up with? Because it's been around a long time, and I think that Chrysler's sort of 5-year plan is almost off track. We hear rumors about like they're rejiggering things as the market shifts, and you know, I don't know what to expect, what they're going to follow it up with, and what they do with Dodge. So I mean, we've commented about the Charger and the 300 and the Challenger, the LX cars a lot. So all of those things still generally apply. It's a solid car for, you know, a decent price. That's about all there is to say about that.
All right.
Yeah, we want to talk more. And it turned out this week, it was an automotive news article, actually, sort of pointing out that the Cadillac has this love-hate relationship with the Escalade. And my first question is sort of like, well, they ought to love it, given that it's a profit center for them. You know, can you guys sort of fill in the gaps and sort of explain maybe why Cadillac, while they love the profit, they hate the Escalade?
Well, I think it's because, you know, Cadillac is sort of trying to change its image right now, and it's trying to say, we do sports sedans, and we do, like, innovative technology things, and we do coupes, and we do all these things, and basically everything that Cadillac's been touting that it's really good at is not the Escalade. The Escalade is this, you know, carryover, shared platform, big, blingy truck that, you know, while very good, and Cadillac has put a lot of good work into it, it doesn't really fit the image the brand is trying to go for right now, even though the brand isn't really succeeding at that image. Because, I mean, Escalade sales are still, like, way more than anything else Cadillac makes.
I love it. I think it's like, I don't think it has to be an either or argument. It's like, you know, right now they've got this cash cow. The transaction prices are great. They don't have to put very many incentives on it, if any. It's still a bulletproof, you know, product. You know, GM SUVs are really, generally, they hold up really well. They have great powertrains. The interiors are pretty good. So it's, I mean, I don't think they should mess with the Escalade at all until, like, some outside factor forces them to change it. Like, you know, just with cafe restrictions, they can't sell it anymore or something like that.
Well, right. It's just like, if you're Cadillac, you know, embrace the fact that you have a product that, for better or worse, in your eyes, resonates well within the industry. You know, it makes you guys a lot of money. I don't think it's a bad, like, flagship for the brand in a way. I mean, maybe it's not the car that you're most proud of in your lineup from like an insider perspective, but you ask anyone who drives one or who knows what it is. I mean, people genuinely like the Escalade And I don't really see why it's a bad thing to have as is. I mean, no, it doesn't fall into this new like CT XT naming structure. And, you know, no, it doesn't have like the new face of the brand, or, you know, it's different, or it's too common to the Tahoe or the Yukon, whatever. Fine. I mean, deal with it however you want to deal with it. But accept the fact that the first thing people think of when they hear Cadillac is Escalade.
Would you roll up somewhere in a Cadillac Escalade? That's the coolest SUV there. I mean,
totally.
Yeah, definitely. You have arrived.
Yeah.
Don't you think that it speaks to a more fundamental issue going on at Cadillac, where, you know, they've been chasing the Germans, right? They've been really trying to compete, and they see themselves as that's where they want to be, and that's okay. But right now, they've got, you know, they're coming out with a flagship sedan, the CT6. Yeah, big deal. We're going to talk about it. We're probably going to say nice things because it's probably going to be very good. But I really don't think that's going to move the needle. What Cadillac needs to do is just, they need to really shore up their sales, right? That's sort of the issue. We'll get more ATS-Vs and CTS, you know, Vs if they can make some profit. And sure, the way for them to make profit is, like, where's their compact crossover? Like, they just redid the SRX to make it the XT5. Okay, great. Like, that's probably the most important Cadillac right now is the XT5.
Right.
Own that and understand that, you know, put your development dollars right now into where you need to make money and get that going now, and you'll be able to do the cool stuff. Because, I mean, they're performance sedans and sort of, you know, sports/luxury cars. They're very good.
Yeah, I mean, the ATS and the CTS, they drive, they're very competitive with anything you want to match them up against. I mean, if you look at, like, you know, our tests and some of the buff books, you know, Cadillacs come out even or ahead in a lot of tests. They're a lot of fun to drive. And in some ways, I think what they should do is sort of like, you know, almost do like a church and state kind of thing. You've got this Escalade and you've got these sports sedans. Both are good. Grow the whole crossover lineup sort of in the image of the Escalade, and, you know, really make your progress, make your hay there, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like move where the food is, you know?
Right.
Like you've got to, with that segment red hot, like, it's cool to have awesome, you know, luxury cars and what Cadillac has always stood for and what they want it to stand for. But, like, you're leaving money on the table and your General Motors prestige brand. That's stupid.
I mean, could you imagine if they did, like, their president, Denyshin, has been actually pretty outspoken about what they're doing and thinking of doing with products. So I think it's one of those things where they could easily do another SUV that fits between the SRX replacement and the Escalade.
Oh, they're going to. That's going to happen. Like, it's the fact of the matter, and this is where the industry is. You have to succeed with crossovers right now. I mean, everyone, if they're not already fully in that game, is getting into it because that's where the money is right now.
And look at what BMW is talking about. They're like, I mean, every day we read another rumor about the bigger X, whatever number they're going to pick for it. They're not there, and they know they're leaving money on the table. Like, they may be winning in sales with the smaller sedans and vehicles like that, but they know that at the top of the segment, the Escalade, even the Navigator, those are still the two big heavy hitters up there.
Yeah, and probably the two most important BMWs right now are the X1 and the X3. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like, for Cadillac to be transforming themselves into BMW while BMW is transforming themselves into a
Cadillac
truck maker,
in some ways.
You know, yeah, exactly. Or, totally. You know, like, it's just, it's a lack of focus. And, you know, that sort of brings me to our next point in topics, which is GMC has been begging for a competitor to Jeep, like a small SUV, and now, you know, they decided they were going to go after the Wrangler with sort of a Hummer-ish vehicle was some of the scuttlebutt a few years ago, and now they want to take aim at the Renegade, and there's nothing there, and GM's boss is, you know, Duncan Aldred, is saying, like, why when you're, you know, General Motors truck brand, do you not have something in the fastest growing automotive segment? And I think that's a really good question. Why don't they have anything?
No, I mean, it's true. Like, GM or GMC, sorry, is a brand solely made up of rebadged Chevys.
Yeah, which is, but it's like rebadged Chevys that appeal to women and have a higher average transaction price. Like those are the
right.
Like that's the holy grail, man.
That's the thing. GMC is like the cash cow of General Motors, especially when you look at like Denali. Holy crap, Denali makes them so much money. And I mean, how many years ago now was it that GMC showed off that Granite concept?
Yes, that's what I was thinking of.
That was a few years ago. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a few years ago, but there was that little guy, it came out and everyone's like, "Oh my god, this is exactly what GMC needs." It looked really good. It had like the sort of new GMC design language. I mean, but it was in that segment that maybe hadn't quite developed yet, but now is like, if you're not there, you got to get there.
Yeah, and it's not like they don't have the parts. It's not like they couldn't put one together. And like GM is really good at tuning vehicles and making, you know, nice interiors and
right.
great styling. Like they've got their mojo going. So
totally.
They could do it.
They could get in that segment and I think win really quickly just because, you know, GM's marketing budget and advertising budgets seem to be huge. Whenever I watch almost any sporting event, it's like nonstop Buick, GMC ads, really all of their
the
brands.
The GMC ad that uses Eminence front and talks about a Rembrandt can paint the corners.
Yes, yes. So, I mean, they've got the money to support their vehicle launches. I mean, the Granite sounds pretty good to me. GMC Granite rolls off the tongue pretty nicely.
Yeah.
Yeah, where is it? Well, exactly. Like, why is it not here? And that's that. Like, that's just, it's ridiculous. And it's not that Buick has it too, because they'll, you know, my assumption is like the first thing they'll do is point you to the Encore and say, well, we have that. And it's like, that's cool. That applies to the parents of the people, or appeals to right. the parents of the people that you want to attract. Like, the average age is higher of the buyer. You know, you probably aren't getting the higher transaction price at a Buick that you are at a GMC, like really they're not the same buyer. And again, it's just another case of like leaving money on the table. And like, this is GM, like you're doing battle for the largest auto manufacturer in the world. Mm-hmm. Where the hell are you on the most popular segment? It's not like it's news and it's growing across the world. You want to be global with your brands, build vehicles that appeal globally. Like what is going on?
No, I hear you.
They need to get there and they need to get there quick. And I think they could totally win there. I think they've got the product guys to make a compelling vehicle in that segment that would be really cool. I think, you know, both of your points, people love GMC. They love Denali right now. You put something like that in that segment, it's going to appeal to a lot of different buyers. And, I mean, let's get crazy here. They could do a Buick version. Make the Buick almost like the Infiniti QX30, Q30 fighter. Make that more like the hatchy thing. And then make this like the rough and tough, you know, truck, you know, small crossover for GMC. And then just go right at Jeep and right at the Fiat 500X, I believe.
Yeah.
You know, just do that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure about sort of like a Trailhawk version of it, but certainly like a Denali version of a GMC Granite.
Oh my God, that would be...
Can trade for like, right, 37, 40K?
Exactly. That would be, I mean, especially something like, because the Terrain is sort of awful. I mean, like something below
ugly.
That, or even something to replace it that is maybe a little bit smaller. I mean, GMC could really use that. I mean, in my opinion, that GMC just really needs like something unique that you can't get at any other brand in the GM lineup. I mean, you can look at a Yukon and then you can look at a Tahoe, or you can look at, you know, a Terrain and say, oh, well, there's the Equinox. And I mean, maybe a lot of people don't see that, especially with like the Denali trims, but I mean, something that GMC can have just for itself. I mean, that'd be great.
I'd love to see what their designers could do with that sort of in that segment, because I
totally.
Think some of the things they do, just even with the trim and stuff, it does make their vehicles look, you know, much more premium, you know, a little more like edgier. And I mean, get in there and go crazy, you know, maybe mm-hmm. the Granite's a starting point. Maybe it's not. But I mean, something like that would be really cool, you know?
Yeah, they've really got to like it's like, you know, it's like when your company matches your 401k, right? And you don't contribute. It's like there's free money there, go get it,
right?
So, and it's a GM truck. Like, this is one of their historic strengths. I mean, even if they call it a compact crossover, like, we know GMC could do this well. They should do it.
Yeah,
and they'd win.
Yeah, well, now that we've solved all of GMC's problems and Cadillac's issues, we should look at Ford, because like that's equally opportunity offend. But we saw a couple of rumors. We saw one rumor and got a confirmation on the other. Today, we just published spy shots of what we think is an F-150 rocking a Jaguar Land Rover diesel V6. And Ford's head honcho said that there's going to be a hybrid version of the F-150 by 2020. So
right.
Those are two rather momentous developments in the light-duty truck arena.
Yeah, I mean, we've heard sort of this rumor of a diesel F-150 for a long time, on again, off again, and, you know, Ford is really good at not telling anyone anything.
We do not comment on future products.
Right, so...
By EcoBoost.
Yeah, I mean, that's all they'll ever say, but... I mean, I seem to remember from as early as this F-150 came out, them saying, you know, yeah, we're gonna do a diesel. And I wouldn't be surprised if it happened. The hybrid thing is definitely more interesting. And especially considering, you know, Ford has been very vocal lately about saying how, you know, it's putting a lot more money into electrification, things like that. So, I mean, there's definitely going to be some sort of alt fuel F-150 soon. I don't know if I favor diesel or hybrid one way or the other for this thing, but diesel seems to make the most sense. But I don't know if it's actually happening or not.
I think diesel makes the most sense in terms of it's a popular subject, and there's starting to be action from the competition with the light duty diesel pickup. So now the time might be right to do it. And Ford, you know, if they've sourced the V6 from JLR, that's probably the most interesting wrinkle to me.
Yeah, like, totally. Oh,
they snagged I wonder what that means for Jaguar Land Rover, if it's propped them up a bit with that deal. That's just inside baseball. But, you know, the ability has always been there to do a diesel F-150. It's more of like, is the desire there? Are we going to sell it? Let's be really careful with our money. Ford has been very cautious, and they've really made some great decisions. So if they're testing that, then it really seems like they've decided that the time is right in the market for it. And you know, pick up on some of that popularity. I think the hybrid is probably the more important development of the two, because we've said it before on the podcast too. Whoever develops like a hybrid pickup truck or a hybrid minivan, like you're going to win. There's, you know, piles of money to be made there. And just, you know, you're those are two segments that could badly use that higher efficiency technology.
I think it's actually surprising. I went back and I actually have the NPR transcript up on my screen here, and Fields just came out and said it. And it's like, he almost would, I'm sure he would never say this around automotive journalists, but, you know, he goes on NPR and he's like, yeah, we're going to do an electrified F-Series and we're going to do it by the end of the decade. And, you know, that's not any hinting, that's not teasing. He's like, yeah, we're doing it. So
it's almost like the man on the moon kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, it is total moonshot. And I think how I think they would probably play it is it's more like they're not going to call this, like, you know, the F-150 hybrid. I think they're going to, the way I would spin it if I were them, is say, hey, this is like the F-150 with electric assist or something. Like, you know, I can already see the ads already with the
Electro Boost.
Yeah.
Electro Boost.
Patent that right now. We would go patent it.
No, make it Electro-Force.
Electro-Force.
Yeah.
I mean, there's certainly, they'll get a lot of press if they go with a hybrid pickup. Like, that's going to be a big development. And if you're first to market with that, like, you're going to get a lot of attention, and then everybody else is going to play catch-up. Like, they're playing catch-up with diesel. You know, look at all the attention that the Duramax and the Colorado and Canyon is getting, like, just because it's here. Or the Cummins and the Nissan Titan. Like, well, you know, fill the holes and you'll get the attention.
They kind of have to walk a delicate line here too, I think, because, you know, a hybrid pickup sounds great. It sounds great, like, in the mainstream press. It's like the kind of thing that you talk about in the State of the Union address or something. But do their buyers want a hybrid truck? You know, I bet if you asked most of them, they'd probably say no. And,
well, I don't know. I mean, I think that some of the large fleet consumers, you know, the companies that are just buying lots and lots of pickups for fleet use, like, that's a cold balance sheet decision, and they'd be happy to cut their fuel costs. Now, the individual, like, you know, you or me as a personal buyer, yeah, maybe not. But
if they sell it, though, I mean, to kind of bring that full circle, if they did sell it as, like, Steve's Electro Assist, well, hey, maybe I do want that in my truck, you know? I save gas, and I get this extra, like, torque on demand while I'm hauling my boat or you know, a broken down dump truck. Yeah, I want Electro Assist. You know, yeah. I think, I mean, it could be a strength.
Think about, like, what did we think about EcoBoost? We were like, we're not sure how well this is going to work, and look how well it's worked. That's the highest take rate. So, mm-hmm. like, they've clearly tapped into something with that, and I think that, you know, a hybrid could keep it going. So, it'll be interesting. By 2020, I want to see what they can pull off, man.
It's yeah. also, like, Ford's really tried to be a leader in the segment. Like, they didn't have to go aluminum. There was no reason for them really to do that. It was expensive. It, you know, it hurt all kinds of different things last year, threw timetables off, but I think the end result is the truck is a little more fuel efficient, maybe not as fuel efficient as we thought or they thought, but, you know, they took the risk and they went first and they, you know, encountered some definitely some negative advertising from GMC and other people. And I think that, you know, that kind of shows that they're willing to go for it, like, you know, with the hybrid sector as well. Because, again, they probably don't have to do that, but the fact that they're willing to take that risk is probably something we should applaud. It's interesting, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if they don't, somebody else will, right? So they might as well have, like, now they have a jump on everybody with aluminum.
Yeah, for sure.
In, like, mass scale production.
Right.
Where it's been, it was a niche thing. So that's sort of the next step is, like, well, if you don't do a hybrid pickup, somebody else will, and they're going to have an edge. Don't you want to be there first with the Ford Edge?
Oh, God. All right. Yeah. We're done with this one.
Yeah. I'll just kill everything with a terrible joke.
Dan just ruined it.
Yeah. All right. So in terms of news and notes, one other thing that sort of popped up that has us chatty a little bit this week is this George Hotz, who was the first person to ever hack the iPhone or jailbreak it or whatever, which I think is kind of an overblown claim in and of itself. He's been profiled as like, oh, he developed his own self-driving car. And there was a big Bloomberg business write-up with him where he's basically taking pot shots at Tesla and saying their autopilot is not as good as the thing that I'm developing because of a variety of reasons. And Tesla's like, yeah, okay, kid. I don't know. It seems like there's a lot of gee whiz about autonomous cars and like hackers developing autonomous cars. And I don't know if you guys had a chance to sort of look into that at all and what your thoughts were on this. Like, you know, he's being portrayed as a sort of lone hacker. The picture of him is in a, like a basement with a water heater next to him and stuff. And like, is that where we're going with like hackable cars? Or are we sort of just making this dude out to be more than he is?
I think he did something really interesting and cool, and now we're kind of blowing it up a little bit. I mean, it's probably the start of a trend, though. Like, one of those things where, like, cars are totally hackable now. I mean, you know, Pete Bigelow has been writing about that all year, you know, the Jeeps.
Yeah.
You know, and I think we're just going to see more and more of it because the infotainment systems, I think, even though they're getting more sophisticated, but they're getting more like iPhones. They're getting more like things people, you know, have literally in their hands every day and feel the need to tinker with. So I think we're just going to see more of this stuff.
Yeah. I don't know.
What's your take on it, though, Stephen? Like, in terms of the sort of, I got this sense of like amazement from the coverage, like, oh, a guy made his own self-driving car. And it, like, I don't think that that's the difficult part, is like making something work. It's more like you're the fleet manager. You see all these cars. They're so good. They're so refined. It's not that you can't build a jalopy yourself. It's that you can't make millions of them and make them not kill people and make money at it, which is what automakers have to do. And oh yeah, there's federal regulations too. So like, what is this sort of impact of this kind of lone guy going to be?
I don't know. I think maybe it's because this is the first one that's really been out there and publicized doing something like this. It's obviously being blown up to, you know, national news. But I mean, where there is technology, there are people to hack it. So get used to it.
Yeah. I mean, he does make interesting points about how, you know, he's got machine learning going on versus like hard coding situations. It's you're training the computer to recognize this stuff. And, you know, I feel like there's a lot of ego at work.
Yeah, for sure.
Reading, oh, yeah.
You should definitely read the Bloomberg business piece. And we have a post going up like very soon about this. You know, sort of he makes a bunch of claims that seem like they're from like left field in terms of understanding how the car business works and how this stuff has to be done. You know, there's some interesting stuff about how you develop this software and you know, which way is better and which way is more elegant. And so it does get the mind working. It felt like a very grandiose piece.
It really makes you think. As,
yeah.
As
oh, they, that's good. Okay. Say. All right. You've killed this one.
I usually definitely. Do.
All right. Q&A, because we got some questions. And I love this one. Is there any merit in buying a new lackluster car? For example, Henry's Mitsubishi dealer will sell him an Outlander Sport for $14,000.
I mean, there's a lot of sort of cachet to the idea of a brand new car, but there's also a lot of really great, gently used stuff that I would wager is probably still better quality than a brand new Mitsubishi that you should go buy instead.
That's how I would play it too. Short answer, I'd go for the used car for 14 grand.
I mean, if you're that, like, what are you trying to scrape together? Like, if it's that you can't get the financing on a used car that you can get on a new car because they really want to keep moving new metal, especially Mitsubishi, like, just, I don't know, be careful. But it's like, an Outlander Sport is, I think I did a quick spin of that, and people got very upset because I was not that kind to it. Because
it's not good.
Because it stinks, yeah. It's not really...
Like, it's actually like, bad.
It's a compact crossover, and we just talked about how great that segment is in terms of growth and choice. Like, it is a choice. It's one of them.
I mean, devil's advocate for 14 grand for a new car. I mean,
come on. But 14 grand for, like, an off-lease Escape?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's not... I would not buy a 14 grand Outlander, but...
No, God, no.
I could see how somebody... Maybe it's got some features they want. That is so cheap for a new car. And, I mean, if the warranty keeps you in the game.
Right. So there are reasons for it. I mean, honestly, if you've only got 14K to spend, go lease something. Again, you know, like, leasing, yes, you're not getting anything at the end of the lease, but you're fixing your monthly cost. You're buying a car you're driving a car that's new, that has a warranty, that has maintenance coverage usually. Yeah. And, you know, at the end of it, like, you know, 14K goes quite a long way with a lease. Like, and you're not going to lease a BMW 335 or I'm sorry, 340i for 14K for very long. But you can probably go lease something for no money down for a reasonable monthly cost for, you
especially
know,
now.
Yeah. So, I mean, it depends on the lackluster car.
I was just going to say that, Dan. Like, the Mitsubishi Outlander thing kind of, I think, jaundiced us a little bit there. But, like, you know, a different car. You know, I don't have any $14,000 cars at my fingertips, but I could see going down that road.
Yeah, I mean, it's so certain, like, why is the car lackluster, too? Like, I would totally drive certain cars that are not considered good cars, but I love them in spite of that. I mean, you could apply that to anything, right? Like the Wrangler's really not a good vehicle. Like, it's not something you want to live with every day, but so many people do. Like, same kind of thing. If you love it, or if you can live with it and live with its flaws, like, I guess it's not lackluster. That's a crappy answer.
Yeah, we're kind of sitting on the fence there, but...
Yeah. Yeah, whatever. All right, let's answer another question so we don't have to continue to flail around. How sustainable is the current economy of cheap gas and the revival of SUV-CUV sales given the pending CAFE mandates that are ratcheting up to 54.5 miles per gallon? You know, what segments are going to flourish and fade?
Well, I think the small SUV segment's going to be fairly safe because most of those vehicles have, you know, smaller V6s or, you know, four cylinders. You're seeing a lot of, you know, hybridization in that segment. I think that one's going to be okay. And I think actually going into 2016, you're going to see very little change. I think everything will be fine. It's as you get closer to those CAFE standards, which I believe are 2018, that's where you can see automakers start to really roll out some aggressive products. And, you know, we'll see about fuel prices. That's anybody's guess.
I mean, aggressive products like a diesel or hybrid F-150.
There perhaps? You go. Like, I mean, exactly.
Ford sells the most of.
Yeah. They're going to kind of really, I'm not going to say force feed, but that's where you're going to see them react because they have to react and they have to get more miles per gallon out of, you know, vehicles that are such strong sellers and mean so much to their bottom lines.
Yeah. Well, and let's not forget too, that it's easier to get a truck to go from 20 miles a gallon to 23 miles to the gallon average than it is to get a car to go from 40 to 42. Like, It's just as you get up there, you start with a more efficient car to begin with, there's fewer gains to be had.
Yeah.
And I mean, if gas prices stay reasonable, which, you know, that obviously hinges on so many different, you know, outside factors. But if that stays low, I think you're going to see automakers and consumers, you know, procrastinate on CAFE as long as possible.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, fuel prices drive everything, really.
Yeah.
People like big cars with lots of room and comfort and performance. I mean, I'd be willing to trade performance for a lot, you know. I just like the comfort. I don't use the performance much anyway, but I don't know. Steve, what do you think?
I don't know. I guess it depends. We're seeing efforts, like big efforts in the right direction, but like, I don't know. I don't think that things are going to change too drastically much. I don't think anything major is going to go away.
I mean, the average price, according to AAA, is $2,007 right now. I mean, why wouldn't you buy the biggest car you could find and, you know, do burnouts every other block?
You and burnouts, man. All right, let's do one more question.
Okay.
last question, really quick. Is it a good time to buy a new VW?
Sure. It's always a good time to buy a new VW.
As long as it's a GTI.
As long as it's, okay, so listen, I was thinking about this the other night when I was driving our GTI home. I would still go buy a brand new Volkswagen. I mean, two of my friends in the middle of this giant crisis were like, we're going to go get a new Golf Sport Wagon with the 1.8T. And I was like, hell yeah, go do it. That's a great car.
That's a good car. I agree with you. I think in some ways, this is almost like, right now, this is kind of like on a simmer. And then every now and then, like a new announcement or new revelation will come out. And then it, you know, goes up to a boil. And that's when the general public gets interested into it. Right now, while it's simmering, I'm not sure the general public cares all that much. And the vehicles that we know are affected are the diesels. And Volkswagen has good engineers. I mean, yeah, you could buy the rest of their cars.
Go get one. They're awesome. Go buy a GTI. Tell them Steve sent you.
I agree with that. All right, I think that's it. Like, we all agree, so we should go.
Buy a GTI.
Lame. Yeah.
Let's all go buy GTIs.
Okay, you send the check to me, I will cash it, and then we'll go buy the GTI.
Perfect.
All right, Stephen Ewing, Greg Migliori. This was podcast number 459. So thanks very much for joining me.
Love it. Thanks, Dan.
See ya.
You can subscribe to the Autoblog podcast in iTunes, send us an email at podcast@autoblog.com, or find us on Twitter @AutoblogPodcast. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.